Certainly God has been good to me, and I'm sure that many in the room can give ample testimony to that basic assertion, which we always want to make a virtual mantra in these very difficult and troubling times. Terrorism in the air, so many people of all racial and ethnic groups struggling with issues of depression, struggling with issues of suicide, issues of family disillusion, profound issues of human sexuality and bioethics. And in the malaise and the very frightening social pathology that engulfs so many of us, I think that we have paused, particularly in such refrains as reminding ourselves, as this song has just done, that despite it all, there is a profound sense in which God is and has been so good to us. Thank you very much for that selection, and thank all of you for being here tonight. What a marvelous and impressive audience you are, and how inspiring is it to look upon this audience in the dais 37 years into the struggle that we are still here and alive. I want to thank my good friend, and he didn't mention it explicitly, but the extraordinary endorsement through this wonderful introduction certainly validates it. He was one of my best students at Howard University. Jeremiah Williams and I go back a good ways, and I've shared his ministry in Baltimore, and we have, our families have been close for a number of years. It's a pleasure, and thank you very much for those comments. And others who I'm seeing tonight for the first time, Bishop Talbot in a long time, and my good friend Bishop Jordan, and many others, thank you for being here and continuing to undergird that vision that was obsessing so many of the African-American leaders within the United Methodist Church in a particular way in that fateful year of 1968, a year that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed, a year when the shrill cries for black power abounded, a year when the Vietnam War was still quite unresolved, a year that was so very difficult for us as black peoples trying to make sense of the Uniting Conference that couldn't even finish its business in 1968 and had to have a special session in 1970. A year which was the launching pad of the National Committee of Black Churchmen, and there's so much vitality and prophetic witness throughout many aspects of the church. And that was the context out of which Black Methodist for Church Renewal began. Of course, against the background of the sadly waning Methodist for Church Renewal, which had unfortunately not proved to be a very effective instrument for social transformation, and cynicism began to engulf it, and we lost our association but felt that we had to move forward. It is an honor to be invited back to address you this evening. I spoke to the 25th silver anniversary, and I trust that the Lord will be good enough to me to bring me back for the golden anniversary. I want to entitle my remarks, "The Pain and the Glory of Our Double Identity on the Eve of Another General Conference," subtitle, "The State of the Black Church." In the Jewish synagogues around the world, the rabbi stands forth at the beginning of the Saturday service and says, "Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu." And he recalls the saga of the Jewish people that dates back to the earliest of the Hebrew times, and that pays particular attention to the 400 years period of bondage in which they were in Africa. Egypt, of course, we have to remind ourselves, is and has always been in Africa. And the remarkable thing about this recitation is that it is a sustained act of memory. And by contrast, I'm sorry to say that so many of us in America today have lost our memory for rich traditions of the past and are witnessing an ex generation of young people of every race and ethnicity in America show signs that are very distressing and quite disturbing. And we need in the church to pay very close attention to it. Last year, for some yet fully unexplained reason, the state of the black church came as a subject very much in vogue in parts of the nation. In February 2003, Tavis Smiley and Tom Joyner of The Morning Show called together an ecumenical gathering of presumed notables in the black church in Detroit's Cobo Hall. It was a much ballyhooed event as a virtual sports and major entertainment event in the midst of televangelism that, of course, sweeps across the nation and gives us the remarkable, if not quite contradictory, spectacle of preachers flying around in Lear jets and having clothing lines on Wall Street and being married in 55 Wall Street. This is the time in which we live. Remarkable events, and that was the context, and we were all told to be particularly inspired by this all-day event on looking at the state of the black church, because it was going to be live on television, C-SPAN, all day. There was a large panel of black theologians and religious leaders from different denominations and groups for the morning session, and another distinguished panel of sorts in the afternoon. How the panel was selected is anybody's guess. I was honored and glad, at least initially, to be among that worthy number. I recall vividly how when we were introduced, coming from backstage, and they would sound your name out, and the cameras were there, I felt like it was, you know, a television show. There were so many people on each panel that few could offer little more than quick sound bites, and then we realized that the main purpose was just to have us there, say very little, so that the tapes could be sold around the country and the profits would be pumped up by the national televised audience. In fact, there were simply too many speakers, and after all, the event would produce tapes for general sale, and the market forces governed even that format. Remarkably, a whole lot of black folks around the country tuned in and watched that show. And like the impressive, even inspiring Million Man March of 1995, there were no plans to implement anything specific. It was a day-long event, a public airing and venting of concerns with no script or enduring substance. Then on April 24th to the 26th, 2003, the United Methodist Ebony Bishops convened a retreat in Dallas, Texas to take up the subject in a more focused and sustained way, informed by such sobering statistics as, quote, the acute proliferation of small membership churches which showed little signs of growth, the alarming absence of young people in the church, and by their own confession, the bishops, the quote, diminished ability of black leadership to advocate effectively the concerns of the blacks in the denomination. For the bishops to admit that was a sign that was very healthy and good, and because it was the basis of a new partnershiping with the general constituencies. Unlike the Cobo Hall event, the Ebony bishops were astute enough to place their retreat within a broader context of urgency, pointing out ominous trends for our people in the areas of deteriorating health, spiraling violence, and disrespect galore in so much black language, hip-hop and gangster rap music, urban dress codes, and both un- and underemployment. The specter is alarming indeed. On the one hand, it is alarming indeed, as a self-consciously, virtually impotent black church at times in the predominantly white denomination seems to be looking on, feeling as if there's little it can do. And on the other hand, there is the massive social pathology in the black community at large, destabilized further by racial profiling, urban displacement under the weight of gentrification, and unspeakable rates of long prison sentences for innumerable black offenders. Unlike last year's Tavis and Tom show in Detroit, the Ebony bishops immediately made plans for a follow-up, one that would even invite significant numbers of our young people to participate in a two-day consultation in Washington, D.C. All of us are grateful to Bishop Rimes Moncure, Jr., and Trudy Kibbe Reed and their respective staffs for the consultations process and the background booklet titled From Oppression to Liberation, Responding to God's Call for the Black Church. That booklet provides an abundance of important but woeful evidence of the sad state of affairs in much of our black churches and the wider communities they seek or should be seeking to serve. Fortunately, I was given a heads up about this consultation by my Mobile, Alabama dear friend and pastor when I'm down in Mobile, which is often, Reverend Frederick Outlaw, who keeps reminding me of the irrevocable call that I long ago received within United Methodism. As I listened to some of the proceedings of the Ebony Bishops Summit on the Black Church last November 7 through 9 in Washington, D.C., I felt a gnawing sense of frustration, wondering whether or not this was little more than another venting of deeply felt problems with few solid solutions, funds, or practical steps to implement a corrective and sorely needed agenda. It might have been better to organize that summit in a general conference mode, with most of the work being done in smaller working committees with specific instructions to committee leaders and then reporting out to the plenary, and that might have then led us more in the direction of recommendations and solutions that could be more helpful. At least it was a fine start, with the Ebony bishops taking the initiative to point us in the right direction, no longer ignoring the extent of the problem and inviting the people to struggle with them in identifying possible solutions. What was striking, perhaps in a major way, about this summit, though, was the scant attention given to the seeming intractability of and the reality of white racism in America, made all the more pernicious by the effects of the continuing racial preference system, which is so often denied even to exist. It still not only exists, but it sustains in so many blatant and subtle ways systems of disadvantage for large groups of our people. Sadly, many of our young people do not understand how the American political economy works. Who really teaches them how the system works? And perhaps we need to think about that as an important part of a new Christian type of education. They don't get it at home. They don't get it in the media. They certainly don't get it in their schools, where they're perceived as behavioral problems more than students there to learn substance. They receive very little from those institutions. So thus, I believe that the church must fill this void through the through after-school and weekend resocialization rites of passage programs that could be widely adopted in many of our churches and sponsored specifically designed for the cultural and political and economic liberation of the hip-hop generation and others who sorely needs first to understand why they are in a context of structured disadvantage and to give them the idea that they, like their forebears in more difficult times, can overcome the odds. We might even want to consider the possibility of sponsoring summer boot camps that could be sponsored by BMCR and the Commission on Religion and Race around the country. What an initiative to help reduce the antisocial and downright criminal behavior of many of our unchurched youth who seem to have lost their way in a nation of greed, violence, and selfishness. The problem is that these children and young people are not dumb. They have gotten the message from America very well. As County Cullen wrote in his wonderful collection of poems, 1926, entitled Copper Sun, we shall not always plant while others reap the golden increment of bursting fruit. Not everlastingly shall we sleep while others hold us their brothers cheap. We were not made eternally to weep. White stars are no less lovely being dark. And then, speaking of black youth and children, and there are buds that cannot bloom at all, even in light, but crumple, piteous, and fall. So in the dark we hide the heart that bleeds, and we wait and we tend our agonizing seeds. For so long we have been tending agonizing seeds. And thanks be to God, through instruments like BMCR, there have been periods in time of time when we said the time for waiting is over. That's a water, please. Our black youth and young adults are those very buds that have not been able to bloom, and it may be left to the black church to step into the widening gap between them and their white or Jewish or Oriental counterparts, who seem to be thriving in many ways in the system. Our resolve must become a ministry that thinks imaginatively outside the box, in efforts that begin to reach out to them wherever they are, and by any means necessary, to show them the continuing power and beauty of Jesus and the unique liberation that Jesus alone offers. When we in the East Coast were struck by the Hurricane Isabel, I was asked to preach at just on the eve of the hurricane's coming. In the chapel, Howard Thurman Chapel at Howard University School of Divinity, and I preached on the very name Isabel. Isa is the Arabic word for Jesus, and Bel from Bella, of course, is beautiful. And I pointed out in that sermon that we must see the beauty of Jesus in every storm. And that is the very thing that we must teach our young people in the storms that have engulfed them. Black Methodists for Church Renewal began in a general conference year of 1968 with all of the horrors that I've previously mentioned. Cities were aflame. Perhaps like never before, Black United Methodist leaders were in a prophetic, proactive mode of Christian praxis. And we are proud to reflect back on some of those days. The General Conference of 4 years earlier had seen floor protests and demonstrations that had finally helped abolish the denomination's lingering structure of segregation and racial blemish known as the central jurisdiction. But in 1968, the mood was different. There was a bold sense of urgency among African Americans, and there was cooperation and focus in the emerging movement that came to be called BMCR. Its advocacy contributed greatly to the creation of the Fund for Reconciliation, to the creation of the Religion on Race, and later BMCR's organized protests, some of which I myself led in Nashville at the Board of Education, and also at the, against the publishing house, that led to the creation of the Black College Fund, as well as the changed ideas in terms of inclusiveness in our publishing, in many of our publications. In those days, I was a brash, young, movement-oriented seminarian who in 1969 was voted in as the first national director of BMCR, big afro and all. My problem was that I tended to take BMCR's founding document, the findings of Black Methodist Church Renewal, a bit too seriously and a bit too literally. I didn't know that religious documents were just ideals on paper like the Bible and that you weren't supposed to take them too seriously. 37 years later, I think that more than a few vestiges of racism remain. Local churches are almost as segregated by race at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning now as ever. The few cross-racial appointments are at best difficult experiments that go against the grain of so much of the social location of America's majority culture. See, you have the fundamental problem of a majority culture that is in denial of its past, and how that past has ill-affected in very deep and profound ways many of its neighbors and fellow citizens. As long as that denial continues, then cross-racial appointments are always going to be problematic. Now don't get me wrong. As predominantly white denominations go, the United Methodist Church seems to me to be still far ahead of the pack of the progressive wing of Protestant Christianity. And I can say that with integrity. There is much to celebrate in our denomination. The election of significant numbers of ebony bishops is to see them in frequent dialogue with their colleagues in the Council of Bishops and in their respective episcopal areas. A significant number of district superintendents who are being appointed oftentimes with some courage across lines that have been established racially. Heads of boards and agencies and commissions in the church, the establishment and support of Africa University, and much more, just in the area of racial justice, about the United Methodist Church and indeed the theology of John Wesley continues to influence the particular approach that we have in the social principles and in the praxis of this denomination. In some ways, it is amazing that BMCR, as I've said, is still in existence. We may not have a national director at the moment, but you are still here. The Ebony Bishops are here, and they have shown an extraordinary measure of support in keeping our forum and Harambe alive. But we must be more than a Harambe. Some years ago, in his book, The Centering Moment, Howard Thurman provided clues for the kind of mantle that we all perhaps must lift up again in the church. When he said, we must keep an anxious vigil by the bedside of a sick world. Think about that. That we must keep an anxious vigil by the bedside of a sick world. And yet our vigil cannot continue to be a passive one of waiting for others to do the right thing or to wait on them to show a sincere agape or the pangs of Christian conscience. It seems to me that our vigil needs to be reactivated on a higher level than trying to just rid the denomination of the church of all vestiges of racism, which is a very ambitious task indeed. In 2004, the needed vigil must include renewed prophetic injections for the patient, a patient that is in danger of losing his very soul, a nation that is also in danger of losing its soul, jarred by the realities of terrorism and the terrorism of deception, the terrorism of official political lies, the terrorism of modes of violence and revenge and multinational imperial greed. That's terrorism too. The moral infrastructure of our nation has never been more dubious than now. We have become the self-appointed police force of the world, the managers or mismanagers of the world's natural resources. Once we were the envy of other nations, but America today is increasingly looked upon with cynicism and even hatred by people in other parts of the world. Posing as the doctor of freedom and democracy, defined, of course, in our own special American way, America has become, in truth, the patient gasping for air and in dire need of massive injections of some spiritual water that can save her very soul. Naturally, two New Testament texts come quickly to mind. Luke 12, verses 13 to 15, the warnings against the deadly sin of greed. And its sequel, Luke 12, 16 to 21, the parable of the rich fool. These passages occur early in Luke's journey narrative, Luke 9, 51 to 19, 27. And remind us nearly two millennia later that even for us, the statement is applicable. You fool, this very night your soul is required of you. Who but the church can position itself to renew its witness to save the soul of a nation in trouble? Here we are faced with the prospects of steadying the legs of the wandering people of God, bent on infighting and self-destruction on petty issues, and of breaking down instead of, we need to focus on breaking down instead of, sadly, as in Israel and Jerusalem today, building up walls of enmity, walls of fear, walls of bitterness. Ephesians 2, 11 to 22, for he is our peace, for he has broken down the dividing walls of hostility in his blood and has made us one. And yet in our actual Christian lives and busy activities as we involve ourselves with the world, we see people building up the very walls of hostility all over again. As I say in a book manuscript, and hopefully I'll finally finish it for Orbis Books, entitled The Mercy of God in a Merciless World, it is perhaps our singular task in this millennium to become the incarnation of God's mercy, not just for ourselves as blacks, but for women's rights, for the Latina and Latino rights, for the rights of Native Americans who can know a sense of justice more than simply having casinos, for Asian rights, or even for a provincial understanding of our own black liberation agenda, which is usually too much focus on economic and political rather than a holistic sense of spiritual empowerment. A spiritual empowerment in solidarity with others who are equally, in many ways, as exploited and oppressed as we have been. Next month in Pittsburgh, where I will be speaking, coincidentally, next Friday at this time, as a matter of fact, at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, the United Methodist General Conference will convene in order to consider, I understand, some 1,200 petitions. Lord. The petitions range from increasing the quadrennial budget by 7.3% to changes in protocols for bishops, to concerns for economic, spiritual, and emotional wholeness for refugees and immigrants. And notice that order, economic, spiritual. I'd like to change that order. See, why couldn't it be spiritual first? To inclusiveness of biblical languages, inclusiveness of biblical language, the men's ministry to the Board of Discipleships, important emphasis on ministry to young people. Some delegates and others are already gearing up for big battles and infighting. Probably on questions of sexuality, gay and lesbian marriages and the like. And others will be prayerful and introspective, preparing for the inward renewal that is supposed to come every Easter so that we all can experience a collective new spring. But for us of the darker hue, will we be mere spectators at the General Conference? We'll be there merely hobnobbing and occasionally attending an important working session, doing a bit of tourist activities, watching the General Conference move forward, and then turning in our expense vouchers? Or will we sound the alarm about the patient that is sick? The patient that needs injections, the patient that is dying before us and risking losing completely its soul. Nina Simone once said, "Oh, I bet you thought you didn't know what to expect from me." Same person, a little older. The theme for this 37th anniversary of BMCR is Journey of Hope, the State of the Black Church. And in my judgment, this theme is timely, provocative, and prophetic, because the Black Church is indeed in quite a state. It is in a state of self-pity. It too easily bemoans its lack of growth, its lack of funds within United Methodism, while it watches other Black megachurches spring up all around. Eventually, I am sure that it will occur to some of us to study what these churches are doing to experience such vitality. Hello? If you're worrying about dying, why don't you ask somebody who's living how they live? The state of the Black church is unfortunately in the same state as the church universal. It is in a retreat mode. It has been bullied by the right-wing Christianity of America, and we should say, I am sick of it, and I'm not going to take it anymore. The unique agenda that should be ours, beginning with the General Conference next month, is the same as it's always been, actually, from the beginning of the New Testament itself. And that is to focus on the health of the soul. The soul of our nation. The soul of individuals within and outside the church in America and around the globe, the soul of the suicide bombers, the soul of the little boy who, trembling before the Israeli military the other day, said, I don't want to die. Can you help me take this bomb off of me? And them sending out a robot. What kind of world have we descended into? In the holy city to see such unholy things. And we stand by as if we have no agenda. And as if there is no problem. The soul of our nation and the soul of individuals within and outside the immediate reaches of the church. The soul of those who languish in prisons, the soul of those in mental hospitals, detoxification centers the souls of those whose furniture has been set out, the souls of those who have endured bankruptcies and foreclosures, the souls of the homeless who we see on the streets. Who will speak to these people and on their behalf in the General Conference on next month. The black constituency of the United Methodist Church has a double identity, and all of the pain and the glory that goes with this unique heritage. We seem to be forever watching America from the sidelines, as in old Hollywood films. We are there, standing, silent, waiting on instructions, have nothing really to say, not a really significant part of the situation, and yet tolerating all kinds of indignities being said, maybe about us and our people all around. But we are caught in this situation of strategic silence for survival. We bear the marks of the stigmata itself, the marks of Jesus' own crucified body, Galatians 6:17. We could tell Mel Gibson a thing or two about living out the passion of Christ. Right here in the United States. We know the pain long associated with our black identity in race-driven America. But thanks be to God, we also know the glory of being on a spiritual journey of an indomitable soul. This is the journey of hope. And I can say that because my name is Cain Hope. Amen. I can also say this as one who has just been informed only a week ago, after nearly a year-long search at Howard University for a new dean, after having become the one of three, then two finalists, having all the indications of stellar, impressive recommendations from eminent potentates within the church and the academy, heavy support from alumni and massive support from the students and the staff, at least ostensibly, and even faculty outward support, and paradoxically enough, the white colleagues full-time, we have three, about 12 faculty, it's the fourth, were clearest and most unambiguous about their desire to have me as the next dean. I was stunned by this reality. My black colleagues eventually came around, but one of the problems that I have with our people is that we still are at war with each other and insecurities. I had all of that support, and on the last day before spring break, I got a letter confidential from the president of Howard University, which I took home and stood quietly in the bedroom before I was going to call my wife to open it, and it said, "You have not been selected." One small paragraph for 23 years of faithful service to the university, an alumnus who is the biggest donor to the school. "I am sorry, you have not been selected." And I was humbled and disappointed and relieved. But at the same time, I had to remember all signs were good right down to becoming the finalist. And alas, the other guy got the job. And once again, I seem to have received the prophet's reward. The pain and the glory of it all. Particular jobs and ambitions come and go. But if we remain focused on our essential spiritual connection, then the momentary pain is transformed into glory. And I was reminded of how appropriate for that moment was the poem of Rudyard Kipling, If You Can Keep Your Head. When all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all others are doubting you and make allowances for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired of waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and don't look too good nor talk too wise, if you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet triumph and disaster and treat both imposters just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and yet stoop and build, become a builder up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings, appropriate here in Atlantic City, and risk it all on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose and start again at your beginning and never breathe a word about your loss, if you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they're gone, and hold on, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the very will to says, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can't hurt you, if all persons count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And what is more, you will be an adult. You will be a Christian. You would be, if you did all that, you'd be the son of God or daughter of God. Amen. Upon hearing, upon hearing of my apparent defeat at Howard University, I went out the next day and got a haircut and a shave. Amen. I put on the great new suit that my wife Jewel had bought me for so that I might have that to wear on the first day. She bought it last Christmas when I became dean. I took that suit and put it on, went to church, sat on the front row of the church. Amen. And on the next day, a Monday morning, I went out to the car dealership. Give me the best car you got here. I'm moving on with my life. I may not have become the dean, but I'm going to ride like the dean. I'm going to look like the dean. I'm going to act like the dean. And I'm going to transform this place. I don't care who you bring here. We're going to raise the standards here. We're going to have Christian witness and training here. I got a driver. He's back there, right back here somewhere. My driver. Yeah, he's doing me, treating me very well with as a driver of the vehicle. We are moving forward. And wouldn't you know it, the announcement was in the Washington Post yesterday. But of all places that I was already pre-scheduled to give a series of lectures just last week, early fact, Monday through Wednesday of this week, was in the very place where the dean designate is. And of all things, the person receiving me at the airport was a member of the executive committee of the board. And when I innocently shared the news of the appointment, he expressed shock because of certain realities that I was not aware of, and I suspect that the president of the university was not aware of. And we said, what are you saying? Are these things true? I am on the executive committee of the board. And so we find that it's not over until it's over. I don't care!
what they got in the Washington Post. I'm moving on. And don't be surprised if you hear that I'm the dean.